Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, Dennis McLean is my name. I'm head of communications at the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. And now, following the launch of the report by Ban Ki-moon, we're going to have a short press conference with the following panelists. On my right is Andrew Maskery, the lead author and the head of Risk Knowledge Section at the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. Beside him is Margareta Wahlstrom, the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction. Beside her then is Oz Oosterk, who's also made a strong contribution to the content of the Global Assessment Report on Disaster Risk Reduction. He's a partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers and a global initiative leader with UNISDR. Beside him we have Mark Cooper, Senior Director, Emergency Management with Walmart. Walmart were one of the 14 leading multinational companies which took part in some of the research for this report. And beside him is Jay Collins, Vice Chairman, Corporate and Investment Banking at Citigroup. Thank you all for being here. And I'd ask Margareta to say a few words of introduction.
Okay. So good morning, and I welcome all the participants, including those that are following us by the live webcast. We've just launched the third edition of the Global Assessment Report for Disaster Risk Reduction. The title of From Shared Risk to Shared Value, the Business Case for Disaster Risk Reduction. And we've just had a session about the opportunities to reduce future risk, understanding the challenges that both the private and public sector have come from, and the importance of that this is a joint effort and all of society effort, that business have a core business interest in also managing and reducing risk, that represents 80 to 85% of all investments. That's private investment. Private investment in the future will in fact be the foundation of how we manage risk in the next decades. The trillions of dollars that are now being invested in lots of marginal areas and high-risk areas, because these are the areas that are still left to be invested in, but also driving economic development in the fastest developing parts of the world, are the dollars that could be invested in a much more risk-resilient manner. With that, I'd like to pass the floor to Andrew for his introductory remarks.
Okay, thank you, and apologies if everyone in the room has already heard them, because I haven't prepared a new set in the last 15 minutes.
Just abbreviate.
I will abbreviate them, yeah. So, this third Global Assessment Report, as Margareta just mentioned, focuses in really on the role of the private sector in managing disaster risk. And I think it represents a subtle shift in approach from, in a sense, protecting ourselves from what we've generally considered to be extreme, unexpected, exogenous events, earthquakes, tsunamis, and cyclones, and actually taking responsibility for the risks which we advertently or sometimes inadvertently generate through our investment decisions. So, and this is actually, for those of you who've had a chance to look at the report, it's actually reflected in the iconography of the report. You'll see a rather peculiar figure on the screen of a person holding an umbrella upside down. And that also represents, in a sense, the shift we're trying to move from. If the umbrella was the right way up, it's perhaps our traditional worldview, as I said, of protecting ourselves from extremes from outside. The umbrella upside down actually starts to represent the fact that the risk is actually inside all of us. It's inside all the decisions we make day to day, as individuals, as households, as communities, and particularly as businesses, because businesses are responsible for such, you know, a large percentage of the total investment. This report, I mean, starts off by looking at the different impacts that disasters have on business, from the most obvious ones, you know, flooded factories or offices, the next most obvious ones, which are interrupted production, but then really looks, you know, goes into perhaps more detail on the wider effects. We actually started this report with the case of the, I think it's actually quite a tragic case, of the port of Kobe in Japan. Before the 1995 earthquake, it was the sixth most important port in the world. And Japan really didn't spare any effort to rebuild the port as quickly as it could. It poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the reconstruction of the port. And the port was up and running again 2 or 3 years later, including with many measures to actually make the port more competitive. But by that time, the business had left. The business had gone elsewhere. It had gone to Busan, to other ports in Asia. And I think the first part of this report starts off by really saying that, you know, once business goes, it may never come back. And that's probably one of the things that, you know, the private sector feels over and above rebuilding factories, etc., which can probably be insured, but you can't insure necessarily against the loss of business and against the loss of reputation which that brings with it. We also, I think, in the title of the report, focus on two ideas. One is shared risks, and the other is shared values. Shared risks becomes, if we make investment decisions in a business that generate risks for us, they also generate risks for, you know, the communities, the cities, and the countries where we're investing. And this is nowhere more apparent, and it's one of, I think, the cases we look at in the report, for example, in the case of the tourism sector in small island developing states. A lot of these states depend on tourism for 60 to 80% of their total value of their exports. So if the tourism sector is developing in a way which isn't actually, you know, risk sensitive, but isn't actually disaster proofed, a disaster for the tourism sector actually means a disaster for the entire economy of these islands and everyone who actually lives on these islands. So when we talk about shared risks, this is what we're really talking about, that the risks aren't just for the business itself, they're the risks for the community. But that's a two-way street, because as we've also stressed, if governments are attracting this investment but they're not making the necessary investments themselves to ensure resilient power supply, water supply, telecommunications that don't go down, bridges that don't fall down, etc., then it's business that suffers. So that's another example of shared risk in the other direction. And the whole message, I think, of this report is how we can really transform these shared risks, which is what we seem to be currently investing so much money in generating, into shared value. Because resilient business will obviously contribute to resilient cities and to resilient economies. And governments actually investing in resilient infrastructure and a resilient environment for business to flourish will be the governments that are most successful in attracting future investment. Mm-hmm. So this is really, you know, it kind of works as a boomerang, no? You know, if I generate risk, I think maybe I'm just going to generate risk for others. Sooner or later, that risk will come back to me. It comes back like a boomerang. And it should be the same thing with the shared value. You know, if we're actually generating value for others, maybe with this kind of approach, mm-hmm. that value will also, have repercussions, positive repercussions for us. That's what this entire report is about. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
That was different to what I said.
Yes.
An hour ago.
Thank you, Andrew. We're watching the clock. We've got about 2 minutes for each speaker, and now I'd like to ask Oz Osterk to make some remarks.
Thanks, Dennis. I'll somehow recover my 1 minute from Andrew. as Dennis mentioned earlier, the PwC participation in the GAR 2013 was specifically around understanding the private sector's view with respect to disaster risk reduction. We went into it with a hypothesis that the private sector feels this is important and that they actually have a lot of expertise in this area, and different industries will have different niches in how they deal with disasters, and that's effectively what we found. There, some of the highlights of our findings are actually within the GAR 2013, but the global release of the full report will be done in London with the great team here and us at our offices on Friday. In terms of some of the key things or messages that that have come out from our study is that, yes, the economic cost and value is rising quite dramatically, predominantly a result of how interconnected our businesses are these days. You know, the supply chains are global, their exposures, as someone mentioned, I think Andrew mentioned earlier, there's a bit of a butterfly effect. If an incident happens in a part of Bangkok, it's going to impact the supply of particular goods and services on the other side of the planet. And the growth has actually been quicker than the system. It's been fast enough that the systems and the processes and the regulation can't keep up. So that's one of the challenges. I'll answer a number of your questions. I don't want to use more than my 2 minutes. But essentially, the one last thing I would add is that there are some very unique assets that the private sector has that can be shared with the public sector. And the opportunity now is for the Hyogo framework to leverage that foundation.
And now I'd like to call on Mark Cooper from Walmart, who participated in the research for this report also.
Thank you. And I first of all just want to thank the UN for the leadership role that they've taken in this area. We think it's extremely important. We've done a lot here in the United States and working with FEMA, state and local government, and it's great to know that the UN is looking globally at many of the issues that we face here in the United States. And we just thank you for the honor of working with you and look forward to continued relationship. You know, with over 10,000 stores in 27 countries, chances are pretty good when there's a disaster that strikes, it's going to impact our company. And we also understand that the importance we play in community resiliency. The sooner that we can bring our stores back online, that's the sooner that a community can return to some level of normalcy. And it's also less resources that have to be expended by government. So we understand that. And we've got several examples here recently. And one with the Japan earthquake and tsunami, we actually had a store manager that traveled by bike for several hours to get to his store to get it open. And when he arrived there, in addition to having customers lined up to get in, to get needed, you know, supplies, necessities, we also had government officials and first responders that were there to get supplies. And what he didn't know was that he was helping, you know, government to basically, again, to bring that sense of normalcy and helping with community resiliency. And that's one of the things I like about our company is that we really empower our managers to make those kinds of decisions during disasters. I mean, obviously at the corporate headquarters, we're doing a lot to support, but even at the very local level, we're really supporting, really support our managers in making those decisions. And then here closer to home, here recently during Hurricane Sandy, obviously working with FEMA, state and local officials, making sure we're sharing good information so that they can know when our stores and clubs are open. So again, that's less resources that they have to expend. And also working with them in state and local government, identifying problems that are preventing us from opening those stores and working on problem resolution. And then, of course, you know, working with the communities and supporting them through donations. We gave, you know, $2 million in cash and in-kind donations during Sandy. We provided supplies to shelters that were here in New York City and elsewhere. And we also utilized our trucks to help transport generators in impacted areas. You know, those are some really good examples that internationally we work towards doing as well. And I'm not originally from the private sector. I spent a number of years, almost 20 years, in government. So I've seen my share of disasters in my time in Louisiana and also in Los Angeles County. So we know, and I know, how much government relies, you know, on the private sector. And going forward, we can see the UN helping in three major areas. One would be, and it's one I've just spoken about, is with the member nations, is that information sharing during disasters, giving us information and us providing information to the member nations about the status of our stores so that we can open them sooner and support resiliency. Second, again, is problem resolution. When we've got a problem or government has a problem, the UN helping facilitate that relationship to identify those issues and to bring resolution. And then finally, just the whole area, again, of donation management, helping us to be more strategic with the dollars that we put out there and the donations so that we make sure they're going to the right areas. Again, moving forward, we hope that you will continue to include us in these discussions. And thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you. And our final contribution from the panel comes from Jay Collins of Citibank. Please, Jay.
Great, thank you. Well, again, I'd like to congratulate the United Nations on on their tremendous work, this report, and Margarita's effort and her team's efforts globally, critical to how we face the dominant issue of our time, which is the continued enormity of the challenges in natural disasters. And I just add a couple points that haven't been necessarily covered now. One is that the report points to concentration risk, and I think it's important that as we look at natural disasters around the world, we look at these concentrations. Concentrations in small and medium-sized enterprises and their disproportionate impact. The small island development states, the so-called SIDS. Importantly, what I've called the serial natural disaster victims countries, which mean countries that are hit year in and year out repeatedly hard. And when we lay on top of that the concentration that's happening in with the urbanization in the world, 450 urban centers, over 1 million people in them, happen to be 80% of them have natural disaster risk. And as the world population booms between now and 2050 to say, 9 billion people, 6.3 billion of those will be in urban centers. And in fact, even more will be concentrated in the megacities. And this is where, in fact, we are most vulnerable. That's why the idea that I've put forward, and certainly hope that the United Nations will help us with, of new disaster prevention principles, not unlike the equator principles that were put out years ago in the environmental space, could have such an impact, particularly in bringing the private sector and the financial services sector together for new standards and compliance in the infrastructure in these mega cities. Finally, I'd just like to again congratulate the corporate private sector side that has participated in not only in this report but the PwC joint report as well, which is equally fantastic, I think, in terms of its insights here. And there are so many ways that the private sector needs to continue to partner with the public sector. And the I just did the math. It wasn't actually in the report, but the PwC $1 trillion after one decade, $1 trillion of economic loss to the world, and the 50% estimate that it's been understated leads you to a $1.5 trillion of damage. And we know that that's growing by leaps and bounds. So the numbers are so enormous, it is really a call to arms, a call to action by both the private and public sector for more cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jay. I just correct you on that last figure. In the Secretary General's remarks this morning, he did say it was $2.5 trillion so far this century in economic losses from disasters. So I'd now like to open the floor to questions. Yes, please.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the insight. Asaf Kanja with Self News. This is very clearly about sustainable development. And I think we all understand that there can be no sustainable development without poverty eradication. So where does the variable of poverty eradication fit in these efforts? And if you can give some best examples that are currently at play, as Mr. Cooper pointed out, and of course Mr. Collins pointed out, but maybe on some of these small island states who really need it the most, if you can provide some key examples on that and where poverty fits in.
Thank you. Any more questions? Okay, we'll give you time to reflect further. Who'd like to start? Andrew?
Yeah. Okay, I'll start first. it'd be very interesting for you to look actually at our 2009 Global Assessment Report, the first one we did, because we specifically focused in on the relationship between poverty and poverty reduction and disasters and disaster risk reduction. It's fundamentally all the data we have, all the risk models we have, basically show that there's a direct relationship between variables like GDP per capita and mortality risk in disasters. So, I mean, more people die in the poorer countries than in the richer ones. And it's the same within countries. You know, the most higher mortality risk is in the poorer areas of the countries, which tend to be poor people out of necessity, often live in the most hazard-exposed areas and in the most vulnerable conditions. So that's not difficult to understand. What is interesting, however, is maybe just to kind of nuance that with what we see in this 2013 report. Because generally, as countries develop, and this you can see in Asia and Latin America and Africa, as GDP per capita goes up, generally their capacity to manage disasters improves. You know, they can respond better, they can prepare better, and the development conditions are better. So it's like saying a flood happens in an extremely poor country, people will die because they can't evacuate, there's no roads, or they don't have access to adequate medical facilities. As a country develops, they'll be able to evacuate, they'll be able to get medical assistance, and there'll probably even be early warning systems. The trouble is we can evacuate people, but we can't evacuate infrastructure. We can't evacuate bridges, we can't evacuate roads, we can't evacuate all the other things we build. So we have a kind of a paradoxical situation in which as countries develop, the mortality risk, particularly for floods, cyclones, the kind of hazards which you can warn, you have warning on, the mortality risk really goes down, and it's actually trending down globally now. You know, it's been one of the successes of disaster risk reduction. But the economic loss risks actually go up because we're building more and more things in hazard-exposed areas. So I think when we look at the poverty side, we need to take that kind of nuancing into account. So we've been, as I said, relatively successful in reducing mortality, but actually getting worse and worse at actually increasing the economic losses, which obviously then have impacts on household livelihoods, education, health, and many of the other human development variables. Thank you.
May I comment?
Please.
I think one of the areas that the private sector can come in and do even more, and we've had some good examples here in the United States, and it's the whole area of education of our citizens. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly in people in poverty, about what they can do to be better prepared. You used the statement earlier, all of society needs to be in this, and that's certainly true. And I know here in the United States, and we're going to be expanding some things internationally, you know, we've worked knowing the reach that Walmarts and clubs have to the communities, being able to get out that preparedness message on what citizens can do in the area of preparedness. We had an event out in California, even for pets, about what you need about your pets. We don't need to forget about those, as well as small businesses through our Sam's Club. So I think, you know, the private sector can do even more in that area. We often talk about what the private sector can do in response, but on the front end, on preparedness, on education, that's something I think that we can do even more.
If I could just add, I said earlier that if you draw a Venn diagram between the world's poorest people in the pyramid, the plight of the financially excluded, and the hardest hit of those that suffer the most from natural disasters, they're virtually concentric. And therefore, one of the things that I'm often surprised at is that we at Citi can talk to an arm of government that is distributing benefit payments and completely focused on aid and development of the poorest, and then go see the natural disaster response team and find that they're not talking. And that seems odd to us, because ultimately the distribution of social benefits and the distribution of aid in response to a natural disaster ought to be thought about in terms of taking the paper and cash out of that process and the manual out of that process to make it more efficient, and precisely because the community is the same.
I have a couple of comments around your question. I think your term sustainable development is spot on. The investments that we'll be making in the next couple of decades will supersede any investments we've made in infrastructure, for example, and economies in the history of man. So that's quite a big risk not to do that in a resilient fashion, in a sustainable fashion. And those decisions are made both by the public and private sector. And reducing poverty is one element of, or one outcome of doing those things properly. But this isn't an emerging economy problem. There is still that traditional perception that this is an Africa problem, it's an India problem, it's a China problem. But it isn't. Like, all you need is a power generator on the eastern seaboard to go down, and half of America is without lights that night. And we've seen that a number of times. And as we become more interconnected, the more exposed we become. So we need to, and that's what Andrew's talking about. It isn't great for people to lose their lives. We definitely want to reduce that, and that's happening. But the economic losses are going up, and that's more about a sustainable future. We don't want people not just to be safe after an incident, but we also want them to have jobs. And one of the findings in the report is in most cases when these incidents occur, it's not just about making them safe, but making sure that organisations like Walmart, etc., are resilient enough to still have a factory there or even just an office there to support their employees, but also the community, so they have jobs for the next 2 years. And they're the hidden losses that we, or the opportunities that we see in part supporting the poverty eradication.
Margareta, have you anything to add?
It's a lot of questions to one answer. But I just want to add to this that, the attention span is classically very short. The disaster is seen as an event, and after 6 months, attention already, even if it's a very large catastrophe, after 1 year, it's basically gone off, and not only by the media, also by the national context, by everyone who has an interest. But if you look at what happens to a community 12 months, 24, 48 months, 5 years, 10 years afterwards, that's when the true impact of the disasters play out. That's when poverty incidences go up. That's when debt increases. That's where small and medium-sized enterprises go out of business and never return. And that's where, countries that are not having all these sort of positive indicators on their side further lose a lot of the opportunities that are so scarce to them already. And that's why you will very often hear the example of Grenada, the Caribbean islands, where their debt keeps increasing after every hurricane impact, because they never have time to really pay off the loans that they've taken to pay for the bridge and the infrastructure. So long term, there is a real harmful impact on their development opportunities, and hence the need to really invest a lot of creativeness, but also a lot of self-interest in that resilience development.
Well, that's your question certainly got a lot of attention. Yes, please.
You want me to introduce myself again?
Yes.
I'm Roberta Witte from Gartner. A question that I asked in the earlier session was around interfaith or faith-based initiatives. In helping people get out of poverty and all, is the UN at all involved in those kinds of initiatives? I mean, because that is such an important thing for people around the world to attend to. It's not just business. Business is a minor thing in reality. So how does the UN get involved in faith-based initiatives? I mean, because there are a number of them going on, and I can't remember the one that I'm thinking of. There's an organization dealing with climate control or climate change, which has an impact on poverty and an impact on disasters. Mm-hmm.
Yes, let me just say that the way we, and I'm, let me say that I take on me to speak for the entire UN right now, but at least for us, because ISDR is really a very large partnership. It's not about the UN already, and really the way we look at the opportunity to manage and reduce future and current risk is a mobilization across all spheres of society, including faith-based organizations. So what you will find is that globally we do it. We engage a lot with their organizations and their initiatives, but also at country level through our partnerships with national platforms and others. It's a very critical constituency because they're also very influential in their own environment. So bringing this to them and hoping that they will engage in it has been quite successful. It's not so visible as many of the other parts because it's a very large and diverse, and some of them are more hierarchical than others. You know, in Geneva, we can go to the World Council of Churches, we can go to the representative of the Catholic Church, but other faith-based organizations are much more distributed. So we're trying in different ways to reach out to use community leaders to in their own countries and regions. So we are not ignoring it, but this time it's this couple of years it's been business. We're also doing the same with young people's organization, of course, with women. This year we will have a lot of focus on people living with disability, and there also we are really trying to reach out to many, many different groups and get them interested in that they have an agenda and something to contribute and something also to offer in terms of knowledge, of course. So that's what we are doing as part of the ISDR.
Thank you, Margareta.
Yes,
I think I'll give a good example. Like the point you touch on is quite important because during Hurricane Sandy, there were a number of faith-based organizations who were setting up shelters. And the challenge is that that's usually done without a dialogue or preparedness, which actually creates an implicit contract with the city of New York to support those shelters. But if there is no dialogue or a relationship, that contract breaks down. So there's a perceived view that, you know, there isn't a dialogue. So one of the most important findings is before the incident occurs, that dialogue has to start a long time ago. I think, Mark, you have a saying, if you're picking up the phone when the hurricane's coming through for support, it's a lost cause. And I think, you know, as Margareta says, just the very fact that there's forward-looking dialogue will mitigate some of those breakdowns in cooperation. But these things, they're not... they're happening on home turf, in a very recent... fashion.
I think it's also important to identify organizations like the Red Cross, Salvation Army, that work with those organizations to help us in making decisions, because you're correct. During Sandy, we were actually getting requests from some of those shelters, and we're doing the best we could to support them. But to be more coordinated, it helps us to make sure we're meeting the real needs. But that's definitely, I think, part. It's not just business. It's just not government. It's just not nonprofits. It's all of us working together to solve these problems.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions? I think we're running over. Yes, one more. Last question.
One question really to Jay. I think your idea about disaster prevention principles for private sector investment and through banking, this is very exciting. And I do hope you will take this forward. I hope that... So I'd like to hear more, a little more about, if you have some thoughts on it. And I think this is a positive outcome of this report, if over the next 2 years something like this can be developed. So.
Well, first of all, I'd say it's only an idea at this stage, my idea. I'll just give you the basics of it, which is that as we've looked at natural disasters in urban areas, I've personally been struck by the failure of government to enforce standards. So standards seem to exist to a large degree. Whether they're the appropriate standards, whether they raise the bar high enough or not, we can do some work on that. But that there are standards that are just not enforced. And in fact, I just came back from Delhi where I met with the seniors in the Bangladesh government and found, again, enforced, serious enforcement issues. Well, we know that the banking system lends to projects that that on a continual basis require covenants to continue to achieve their financing objectives. So the financial system actually has a tool, a stick, so to speak, on an ongoing basis with projects to ensure that enforcement of standards is achieved. And there are a variety, this isn't the forum to get into some of the technicalities that can be done, but there are a variety of tools that the financial system could bring to bear, just like they did, and I just took as a concept the Equator Principles, where the sector came together and everyone agreed that we would not finance project finance unless there were standards that were met in the, on the environment. And everyone had to agree to that because you couldn't have a couple banks do it and others not. So with that as a concept, I think there's room to tweak it and massage it. It does require, I think, the auspices of someone like you, Margarita, that, that can help us think it through and convoke industry participants. Mm-hmm. But that's the thought.
Thank you very much, Dave. Well, it remains for me just to thank our panelists and to thank you all for attending and to thank those of you who have been listening to the broadcast. I believe the next briefing is in 8 minutes' time, so we'll vacate the room. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.